Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots, and partially solar-powered community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of the show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get some notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. As always, we look at some debt-related news and facts for the week to start off the show. Last week, I was talking about an article from the Huffington Post investigative fund, Banks Paying Colleges for Students Who Rack Up Credit Card Debt. And I'd like to continue that article this week because it's very meaningful for families. On May 22, 2009, President Obama signed sweeping new consumer credit card protections into law. All too often, Obama noted at that time, Americans used credit cards as an anchor rather than a lifeline. Students were no exception. The Credit Card Accountability, Responsibility, and Disclosure Act prohibited banks from using some of their most aggressive marketing practices on students. For instance, banks can no longer require students to apply for a card to receive promotional gifts such as pizza or sweatshirts. Nor can banks supply credit cards to anyone under age 21, most college underclassmen, unless the customer has a cosigner. The law requires only that the cosigner be over 21. The cosigner needn't be a parent or guardian. The law, however, does not prevent credit card companies from paying schools for special access to students, as we discussed last week. Chase Card Services, a division of J.P. Morgan Chase & Company, has a handful of such agreements, but Bank of America dominates. It became the market leader in 2006 when it acquired credit card giant MBNA, a pioneer in affinity agreements that often involve pro sports teams and professional associations. Soon after the acquisition, Bank of America set its sights on colleges. At a March 2006 conference hosted by Goldman Sachs, Bank of America executive John Cochran described students as an emerging market that we could really capitalize on, according to a transcript. From a bank's perspective, students represent an important demographic. Not only do many first-time cardholders hunger for credit, they are likely to stay customers for quite some time, up to 15 years, according to a 2005 study by Ohio State University researchers. Student credit cards are hugely important to a bank, said Kerry Policy Growth, who negotiated collegiate affinity agreements as an MBNA account executive from 1998 to 2005. Your first credit card is usually the one you keep. Although Bank of America does not disclose how many student accounts it has or what it earns from student credit cards, Cochran, at the 2006 conference, characterized the collegiate affinity market, students, faculty, alumni, and sports fans, as an over $6 billion portfolio. The portfolio may have declined in recent months as the bank's entire credit card business has suffered from rising default rates. Bank of America spokeswoman Ms. Reese emphasized that the bank primarily targets alumni and fans as prospective customers, with students accounting for about 2% of all open collegiate accounts, likely representing thousands of young consumers. Affinity agreements vary from school to school. The University of Pennsylvania's agreement with Bank of America required the school to compile an initial list of 233,000 potential customers, including students, alumni, faculty, and staff, to offer the bank. If requested, the school removes potential customers from the contact list. When Princeton University signed its affinity agreement with Bank of America in 2004, it agreed to provide the names of at least 4,000 students and 75,000 graduates. After a bank obtains the information, it can send an agreed-upon number of solicitation letters and emails. A 2008 PIRG survey of more than 1,500 undergraduate students found that about 80% received mailings from credit card companies. Some affinity agreements also permit banks to advertise at school sporting events. Banks often have booths at football and basketball games where students 21 or older, alumni and fans, can sign up for a card. Colleges and alumni associations are entitled to rewards for providing special access and information. Bank of America typically pays schools $1 for each student who opens a credit card account and keeps it open for 90 days, according to contracts reviewed by the investigative fund. Some schools also can earn more as students rack up charges and debt. The University of Oklahoma, among other schools, is entitled to receive 0.4% of all retail purchases made with student cards. Most of the 17 contracts obtained by the investigative fund entitle schools to extra compensation, up to $3 a card, when students carry a balance from year to year. Essentially, contracts with credit card companies are using students as commodities to earn revenue for the universities from companies who don't necessarily have the students' best interest in mind, said PIRG's Mier Zwinski. As part of many agreements, banks also pay for rights to use school trademarks, mascots, logos, and emblems on their advertisements. Banks often brand their cards with familiar images. This marketing tool, known as co-branding, has its critics. Irene Leach, associate professor of consumer studies at Virginia Tech, said the practice leads some to believe that universities have negotiated favorable credit card rates for their students. Alumni and students both think that it's the best deal out there that the school could get for me, an assumption that is not always correct, she said. Nor do students necessarily get the lowest rates. At Princeton, alumni cards carry an annual percentage rate of 11.9%, compared to 14.9% for student cards, according to the school's 7-year affinity agreement signed in 2004. Rates may have changed since then. Bank of America currently charges a 14.24 annual percentage rate on its Student Visa Platinum card, the primary product it markets to students. Students are not locked in. The rate varies depending on the market's prime rate. The bank said it doesn't increase rates on students for reasons such as falling behind on their payments, nor does it impose an annual fee. We take a conservative approach to lending to young adults, Bank of America's Reese said, noting that the bank limits a student's exposure to debt. The bank offers credit lines for students that typically start at $500 and are capped at $2,500, she said. The bank, Reese said, also seeks to educate students. We also provide a number of tools to help young adults better manage their finances, she added, including free identity theft protection, a student financial handbook, and an online educational brochure about building good credit called The Essentials. Building a future customer, that was really the goal of affinity agreements, said former MBNA executive Groth. You're not out to gouge them. You want a positive experience. This spring, Columbia University, the Iowa State University Alumni Association, and Michigan State University all amended their affinity agreements to prohibit any marketing to students. They did so within a week of receiving phone and email inquiries from the investigative fund. school officials said they have been working on the amendments for months. The investigative fund requested Columbia's contract on March 22nd. Columbia officials signed the school's amended agreement 2 days later. The timing was mostly coincidental, according to Michael Griffin, executive director of Columbia's Alumni Association. He said that the school had never allowed marketing directly to students. Seven other schools contacted by the investigative fund said they no longer allow marketing to students, even though their affinity contracts would appear to obligate them to. School officials said they had no documentation backing up their assertions. A lot of schools have student access in their agreements, but don't necessarily allow it anymore, said Peter Osborne, who managed the collegiate credit card business at Bank of America until 2007. Schools sometimes informally just request that the marketing stop rather than reopening their entire contract. For instance, according to an affinity agreement between the University of Texas Alumni Association and Bank of America, the association is expected to provide the bank with students' names and addresses, but the Alumni Association says it has abandoned that practice. We are not marketing to students at this time, and we haven't for some time, said Brad McCausland, Chief Operating Officer for Texas X's, the X Students Association. Whether the contract allows us to or not, we are not doing so. He acknowledged that students could still sign up for credit cards without the school's involvement. Bank of America, he said, is still marketing our card, and they are doing a very good job at it. At Harvard, the Alumni Association is supposed to provide a subsidiary of Barclays PLC with as complete a list as possible of all Harvard alumni and students, according to the association's affinity contract. But Harvard spokesman Kevin Galvin said the card was never marketed to students. We view this card as a service to alumni, he said. Other schools acknowledged to the investigative fund that they released students' contact information. These schools staunchly defend their affinity agreements as important sources of revenue, and some royalties benefit students, according to schools and bank officials. The revenues from this go to vital services that otherwise might not be free and otherwise might not be offered, said Osborne, the former bank official who now advises universities as they negotiate affinity agreements. Osborne said the revenues support alumni programs, student scholarships, and preserve jobs within alumni associations. Some of the royalties from Penn's contract go to scholarships and help pay for the development of Campus Express, an online system where students can order textbooks and manage their dining plans, according to the university spokesman Ron Ozio. Princeton uses its profits to support alumni activities, spokesman Emily Aronson wrote in an email. Catherine Bishop, Vice President of Public Affairs at the University of Oklahoma, said affinity agreements are beneficial because they limit the amount of marketing that goes on. The contract that we have in place, she said, is designed to keep multiple companies from soliciting on campus. So that was a Huffington Post article by the investigative fund, Banks Paying Colleges for Students Who Rack Up Credit Card Debt. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now I'd like to continue with our study of the two-income trap, Why Middle-Class Parents Are Going Broke, which is a breakthrough book by Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard and her daughter Amelia Warren Tiagi. Please note that the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in these programs are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of Professor Elizabeth Warren and her daughter Amelia Warren Tiagi, who are two of America's leading champions for debtors. I highly recommend their books, All Your Worth and The Two Income Trap, and I also recommend that you go to the archives at www.kruufm.com, look under Life and Debt, and you can listen to all of the shows that have been produced to help you deal with debt from all different angles and levels. Continuing on with the two-income trap, the problems posed by families deep in debt may seem intractable, or at least so deeply embedded that only a complex, really expensive array of regulations and laws could turn things around. And we see that a lot these days in the media. But according to Professor Warren and her daughter, the problem isn't so hard to solve. The consumer credit monster could be beaten back if Congress would enact a simple provision into law, a provision that wouldn't require the creation of vast new oversight committees or contentious battles in the U.S. Supreme Court. Congress could, very simply, revive the usury laws that served this country since the American Revolution. Federal law could be amended to close the loopholes that let one state override the lending rules of another, which has happened. Alternatively, Congress could impose a uniform rate to apply across the country. Such a provision would enable the states or the federal government to reimpose meaningful limits on interest rates, which is really the critical factor in creating much of the debt and the consumer's inability to pay it. Now, consumer lenders usually balk at the notion of re-regulation, immediately claiming that tighter limits on interest rates would put America at risk for another banking disaster like the savings and loans disaster, the crisis in the late 1970s. We're still hearing this every single day in the news. Looking back at the savings and loan dilemma, they were hemmed in by high inflation rates and low limits on interest rates. The SNLs, which issued most home mortgages, found themselves hemorrhaging money. But the real problem was inflation, not usury rates per se, which had worked reasonably well for centuries. At the time, usury limits in most states were fixed at a specific number, and they hadn't been written with double-digit inflation in mind. But that would be an easy problem to solve. To avoid a repeat of the SNL crisis, all that is needed is to tie the limit on interest rates to the inflation rate or the prime rate, which changes with inflation, so that the two never get too far out of sync. So this keeps a check on fees, points, and all the other hidden charges if they are also included in the interest calculations up front. That way, mortgage and credit card interest rates would be higher when inflation is rampant, but they would come right back down when the inflation monster is tamed. The ceiling on interest rates would float up and down, but it would always be tethered to the lender's cost of the funds. That way, banks would always be able to lend profitably, and consumers would always be protected from unreasonable rates. So this is one theory by the professor. She states further that the beauty of this approach is that it would help families get out of debt without costing taxpayers a dime. By harnessing the energy of the marketplace, lenders themselves would transform mortgage and credit card practices just by acting in their own best interest, since they would no longer be allowed to charge exorbitant interest rates to families with marginal credit records. It would become unprofitable for lenders to pursue families in financial trouble. Instead, banks would once again have a strong reason to screen potential borrowers carefully, making loans only to those who really can afford to repay. Which, even though these words were written before the current recession, the principle stays the same. Banks are still out there, either one, not lending at all, or two, going after the lowest level of earners to try to get their money with high interest rates and charges. Now, there, of course, is an anti-regulation camp, and they are ready to explain why regulating the credit industry, or any other industry for that matter, is a bad idea. On the surface, their logic sounds convincing. A deregulated market reduces costs and provides more choices for home buyers and credit card holders, so consumers would win out eventually. As a federal judge, Edith Jones, wrote, "Nobody is holding a gun to the consumers' heads and forcing them to send in credit card applications. People always have the option of walking away from an overpriced mortgage offer or an outrageous credit card offer." But this kind of argument rests on one very important supposition: a well-functioning market for credit. An honest economist will explain that markets work efficiently only when there is a level playing field, when consumers have, one, full information about the costs, and two, full information about the risks associated with whatever they are purchasing. The evidence is strong, however, that the lending playing field is anything but level, and we all can see this very easily. After all, if the market were working properly, how could Citibank have sold 40% of its high-priced subprime mortgages to families with good credit who would have qualified for low-cost mortgages? How could the company's loan officers have gotten away with charging extra fees to anyone who appeared uneducated? And why would low-income whites get better terms on their mortgages than high-income African Americans? A perfect market free to operate without government interference certainly sounds good, but it is little more than a fantasy held up to distract policymakers while lenders rake in profits from those who never quite figure out the terms in fine print. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So we've been talking about regulation. Now, the argument for re-regulation of consumer lending is a lot like the argument for regulating any other useful but potentially dangerous product. Professor Warren often uses this example. She says, consider the toaster. People buy toasters for home use. No one makes them buy toasters, and they could, of course, live without toasters. If they understood electrical engineering, they could evaluate the safety of each toaster under every possible scenario. But toasters are regulated. No toaster manufacturer may peddle toasters that have even a 1% chance of catching fire. Toaster makers and conservative economists could point out that riskier toasters could be made more cheaply, and that permitting their sale would expand the number of toaster owners in the country. Companies might put special disclaimers and instructions on their toasters, telling customers how to extinguish the fires themselves. But as a nation, we have collectively decided that the risks posed by an unregulated toaster industry are simply not acceptable. The government regulates the sales of millions and millions of products, everything from children's pajamas to aspirin to automobiles, to protect consumers from the risks of substantial injury. For most of America's history, loans to consumers fell squarely within that definition. Interest rates and other terms were carefully limited by state legislatures and patrolled, when necessary, by state attorney generals. Predatory loans may not set houses on fire the way a faulty toaster might, but they steal people's homes all the same, as we see now the epidemic of foreclosures across America. America has had more than 30 years to observe the effects of a deregulated lending industry, and the evidence is overwhelming. It's time to call the experiment a failure. Re-regulation would help solve a litany of evils. The most important is worth its own headline. Limiting interest rates would halt the rapid rise in home foreclosures. With a lower ceiling on interest rates, lenders would lead the charge to reestablish an appropriate match between family income and mortgage size, which would have the effect of reducing the mass of families that are sucked into mortgages they have no hope of ever paying. Minority communities would no longer find themselves stripped of wealth by predatory subprime lenders. and homeowners would no longer be suckered into second and third mortgages that promised to lower their monthly bills, but that actually robbed them of the family home. Remember, 80% of these mortgage failures are on refinanced loans. Interest rate regulation would also take the ammunition out of the middle class bidding war, helping to save families from the two-income trap, which is what Professor Warren's work is all about. Competition for the best neighborhoods would continue, but if no one could get a mortgage that ate up 40 to 50% of the family's entire income, then the home prices would begin to settle down to earth. To many economists, this is a scandalous notion involving a reduction in America's net worth. But the net worth isn't worth anything unless a family plans to sell its home and live in a cave, because the next house the family buys would carry a similarly outrageous price tag. Some families with weaker credit histories or more modest incomes might find themselves limited to smaller houses, but they would also be far less likely to end up in a home that drove them into the bankruptcy courts. Also, as housing prices leveled off, more families would be able to afford a home without having to resort to a subprime mortgage. Re-regulation of interest rates would bring relief to all families, not just those already in serious trouble. Families would also be far less likely to get into trouble with their credit cards. With appropriate limits on interest rates, banks would still be able to issue credit cards profitably, and consumers would still have access to those convenient plastic cards, although I am frankly much against it. But banks would have far greater incentive to screen cardholders, offering only as much credit as each family could repay. There would be no incentive to single out families in financial trouble, as has been happening, tempting them at the moment when they are most vulnerable with special offers of extra credit at exorbitant rates. Banks would have no reason to scour credit records looking for homeowners in trouble, offering to solve their credit problems by putting their homes at risk through second or third mortgages. Limits on interest rates would reverse another disturbing trend, according to the professor. That is the transfer of wealth away from lower and middle class income families. Since 1970, banking profits, inflation adjusted, have more than tripled, growing by more than $50 billion
just up to the turn of the century, and exploding in the last decade to unimaginable heights.
Those profits weren't the rewards for important innovations. Lenders didn't invent a faster computer, design a better car, or make a great new movie that everyone wanted to see. Indeed, many would argue that the quality of banking service actually has declined during this period. But what happened was they sold pretty much the same thing they always had, debt. The difference was that they sold more of it and they charged much higher prices.
Next week, I will continue with this topic and show some examples illustrating what is happening to American families.
This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous, debt-manageable life.